Hi, folks. Denise Howell here, and you're joining us for Uneven Distribution here on the Hearsay Culture Network. I am here with one of my favorite people on the planet, Evan Brown. Hi, Evan.
Hi, Denise. That is such a nice thing to say. I appreciate that.
It could not be more true. Evan and I used to co-host This Week in Law on the TWiT network and have known each other in various ways and knocked around the internet sort of adjacent to each other for the longest time, the early 2000s, I'm going back to here.
Yeah, and 20 years, but probably,
yeah,
sure.
Yeah. Exactly. We were just chatting about our kids who used to be little and are now big. And of course, Evan, you haven't changed a bit.
Well, I was thinking the same to you. I thought this was also a time machine, and I was talking to, like, you know, 2006 or something. But you know,
let's go with that. Right. Although here on my show, Uneven Distribution, what I love to do is talk to people who have what I like to say is they've been living in the future, borrowing from that William Gibson quote that says the future is already here. It's just not evenly distributed. And one of the things I've always enjoyed about you, Evan, is the way in which you're sort of aw shucks about it, but you've been living in the future for quite some time with the way that you think about your profession and the tools that you use. And that, you know, both of us practice internet and technology law. And you can't really do that without living in the future a little bit, because you're constantly coming up against the fact that our laws aren't really designed to comfortably accommodate all of the technological developments that we've seen over the last 20, 25 years. And what those developments then do to society and the way that we live our lives. So I wanted to take the time to get together with you today and talk about the various ways you have lived in the future in the past and are living in the future now. And where I'd like to start, I guess, is some of the things that we used to talk about a lot on This Week in Law, and sort of looking at them through the perspective of today's developments and where we think these things are going. So they were sort of ongoing themes for us on the show. And the first one I want to start with, on that show, we would always have an animal selfie of the week, because one of the things that happened during the course of our run there was the famous monkey selfie case out of the Ninth Circuit in California, where there was an issue about whether Naruto, a macaque, if I'm not mistaken.
I think there's some controversy over whether Naruto was a he or a she, right? Do you know for sure?
I'm going with they, them until I know otherwise.
Okay. but I didn't see a label. So
the question was whether they could have the copyright in a photo that they took when they picked up a camera and took a photo of themselves. And there were, believe it or not, there were years of litigation over that question. And that issue is not dead today. It's not so much whether we're stuck on whether animals can have copyrights or intellectual property rights in general. But of course, the next logical step is the world we're living in now, full of AI and large language models and the tools and creations that they involve. Why don't you tell us, Evan, how the Copyright Office is approaching this monkey selfie issue these days?
Right. Well, I think the real key to all this is personhood. You know, what does it mean to be a natural person? And then once you start peeling back those layers, you get at some of the essential things that underlie the whole theory of copyright, or at least the notion of the domain that copyright covers. And that is human creativity. In copyright, we talk about originality. In everyday discussions, you think of originality as being something, something that's attention grabbing because it's new and it's original. Oh, isn't that clever? Something like that. But originality, the emphasis in the copyright parlance is the root word origin, you know, originating from the human mind, the human intellect, so that it becomes intellectual property. So this question of personhood becomes relevant. And, you know, if we start the narrative with Naruto, that sort of misapprehends this notion that the idea goes back, a lot further than that, as to who is it that is entitled to personhood? Who is it that then ought to have intellectual property rights? And the Copyright Office takes a relatively, we'll say, conservative position in the sense of saying that only natural persons can be owners of intellectual property. So what does that mean for us? Well, animals don't own copyright, and that's aligned with what we get from that thread of jurisprudence that arose from the Ninth Circuit in the Naruto case. But clearly, and I think this is where we can sort of set the table for discussion, question then becomes, who has the right? What rights exist? Who owns the rights in works that are created by artificial intelligence, those technologies that allow for the creation of visual works, textual works, and then one of these days we're going to see Sora, right? And so, you know, who owns the copyright in those? So far it looks like people, flesh and blood people, are winning out in the analysis of who it is that actually owns copyright rights in things. But gosh, it's got to be one of those things we're going to have to continue to examine, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely. And I think that the bodies that we look to help us decide whether rights exist and who gets to enforce those rights, that they're going to have to develop their approach as well, because the Copyright Office came out, what was it, late last year, and said
2023 sometime.
Yeah. And said that works generated, the AI generated works, were not going to be copyrightable. And then just earlier this year, have backtracked just a bit without a whole lot of guidance, saying, well, if it's AI assisted, but there's a lot of human creativity involved still, then that's a copyrightable work. But we don't know what degree of human involvement there has to be, originality there has to be. So that's all kind of an open question. And then
doesn't that drive you crazy as a lawyer? Because if you then think about how that's actually going to work out, that's so fact specific. And one of the most tortuous things about being a lawyer is applying the law to facts, or plugging facts into the law. And so if you have this thing that's created, this image, and the parties are arguing over, you know, what part was created by the machine and then what part was done by the human, you've got to separate all that stuff out. And it's just, you get a headache, your head sort of starts to spin thinking about it. So, you know, as I much prefer sitting here talking about it at the theoretical level rather than, you know, jumping into it, which inevitably we'll have to do one of these days. But anyway, don't want to derail you where you were going there on that.
Well, the reason I think that the Copyright Office and possibly the Patent and Trademark Office, which deals with things that are invented as opposed to artistically created, that they're going to have to keep their minds open about all this, because I feel like where we are right now is where we were with writing when spell checkers and grammar checkers came along. You know, at first they were kind of new and novel and would, definitely make you a better writer if you were using them, but not everyone was using them. And now everyone uses them, and you're not going to have a written work that hasn't been processed through some of these tools. And I feel like that's where we are with AI, that, you know, looking into the future here, you're really not going to have completely human generated works. And in fact, we don't have completely human generated works right now, or they would be filled with grammar and spelling errors, not to mention formatting errors and everything else. So I just think that, you know, obviously we're talking orders of magnitude different when we're talking about the creative process itself, as opposed to the formalistic things like spelling and formatting.
Well, do you remember the Cerrone case? I know we had to have talked about that over here. That's the Picture of Oscar Wilde case. It went up to the Supreme Court in the 1880s. And the issue in that case was whether photographs are protectable by copyright, because the copyright clause of the Constitution only talks about what, scientific discoveries and writings or something like that. So is a photograph a writing? But really the more direct question is, you know, can you be an author of a photograph? And is that something? And the way I always like to mention the fact that President Lincoln signed a bill that amended the Copyright Act that brought photographs within the purview of the Copyright Act, but it was, you know, another 15 or 20 years before the Supreme Court actually confirmed that it was constitutional to amend the Copyright Act to allow photographs. But if we put ourselves back into that space and we think traditionally of copyright, you know, pre, you know, this period of 1860s, 1880s in time, copyright being, you know, books, you got the Stationers Act, you know, and all the Statute of Anne and all the things that this limited monopoly was supposed to grant, those types of works. It really would have been quite revolutionary to think of a photograph being protected by copyright because of the dramatic extent to which the machine is responsible for the generation of that work. So we don't have to think that this is the first time we're thinking through these questions of how do machine and human intellect interrelate for the questions of copyright. And I think your a prescription? The fact that the intellectual property offices have to have an open mind on this is well taken, because it's this continuous dance between human and machine, you know, creating these wonderful things.
Yeah, 100%. And your point that a human, you and I sitting here, mm-hmm. you know, are viewing visual images of one another, yep. and others, if they're watching the video of this show, are viewing the two of us. And none of that could happen without a machine. You know, you and right. I could not depict ourselves in this way. So I do think that you're right that the law has dealt with some of this stuff before, and it's not going to be quite as revolutionary in that sense.
Yeah. Because what I'm listening yeah. for is, what is it about the use of artificial intelligence to generate content that is, you know, different in kind, that mm-hmm. makes it so that the law ought to regulate it in some way that the law hasn't regulated works up to this point? And I'm not so sure I can identify where that Rubicon is, or if there even is a Rubicon there, that once we use machines to generate works like this, then the law has to be very different. But until we get to that point and machines then can have rights, you know, does this machine own the copyright in that thing? We've got to be very careful, because, and this is probably not a direction you want to take this conversation yet, but what is the corollary of a right? Well, the other side of that coin is, you know, an obligation, mm-hmm. A duty, you know. So what duties then do these machines have? And then what other rights ought they have, because they have these duties? When do machines then have the right to cast a vote in an election, for example?
Or right, and what sort of liability considerations yes. are there, even if the machines themselves don't have liabilities or rights, perhaps their companies that are creating them do.
Yes.
And yes. Have
I think we should probably cast yeah. Will Smith somewhere in that.
Yeah, you know? Exactly. In maybe two or three roles. Yeah. All right. One other thing that we talked about a lot on This Week in Law, where I was maybe a little bit correct in where things went, but you were far more on top of at least where we are currently, and that is the whole realm of cryptocurrency. And what the heck was going to happen there? Because back in 2011, I and others thought that, you know, our ATMs would be spitting out crypto, we'd be paying for our pizza with crypto, and yeah. Yeah. and that it would become this sort of parallel form of currency. And I would say I sort of, you know, salvage a bit of that, in that it has come farther than it was way back when. And there are some countries that have adopted crypto as their default right. currencies. But other than that, it's kind of been a debacle, and you were all over that from the beginning.
Okay. Well, blockchain did not go the way that I thought it would. So I think you and I can be kind to one another in this, this category here, because you could easily queue up, you know, the segment from that show. You said it was 2011, I believe you, when we were first talking about Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. And I said, oh, a year from now, we will have even forgotten the word Bitcoin. We won't even know what, you know, it's sort of like, you know, black sheep Firefox hack. You remember that? You don't know. No, you don't remember that. It was the, you know, thing du jour, but, you know, so, you know, blockchain is, you know, is very much a thing. You know, I mean, we don't have ATMs on every corner with, you know, cryptocurrency, but don't you think there's still quite a bit of promise in blockchain that we haven't even thought about? I never would have foreseen NFTs, for example. I don't know if NFTs are still going to be a thing. You know, I mean, I'm sure I'm raising hackles among diehard NFT purists, you know, by saying, are NFTs even a thing? But in the way I'm sitting here right now feeling, NFTs are very, you know, so 2021. but yeah, it's been interesting to see, you know, blockchain and cryptocurrency develop. Yeah, for sure. I'm glad you're raising it as an issue.
Yeah, definitely. Any predictions going forward? You just think we're going to see more creative uses of blockchain?
Don't you think we'll probably see more practical applications of it? You know, the things that are great about it in terms of its security and its auditability, its anonymity, you know, authenticating things, you know, ownership of things in the real world. Now, I'm not saying anything new. This could have been things that smarter people would have been saying prophetically, you know, 10 years ago, where it's going to go. So, you know, candidly, I don't have my finger on the pulse of blockchain right at this very moment, but I wouldn't be surprised to see some kind of reemergence or renaissance or recasting of it that might bring it to the public consciousness in much the same way as happened in November of 2022 with ChatGPT. There's a thing called artificial intelligence. People know about it now. Maybe it will come out of the realm of sort of an elite kind of SETI, come into the realm where your grandma could actually use blockchain technologies, and that might be a watershed moment. But I don't know what that will exactly look like.
Yeah, riffing on that, I would say a likely place for that to happen is just with either business data or personal data, or perhaps both, which I feel is still so out of people's control. And it's interesting for you and I to sit here and think back to the beginning of our law practices when everything was done with paper and you had to take notes and use sticky notes to find things later and index and all of that. And
how we use the word tag as sort of like bringing that over into the digital realm.
You know? Yeah, absolutely. And now at least, you know, we can full text search things and apply AI to those searches to help make those universes of data more usable, accessible, and comprehensible. But I still feel like, you know, all of you and I both have kids and families. We've been taking digital photos since we got our first digital cameras and then phones. And I just feel like I live in this sort of cloud, not in a good way, of data that is difficult to access that one particular thing that I need at the particular moment. And so I do think that blockchain could be useful for just helping us wrangle some of that.
Do you still have a Flickr account?
No, because I think they, I'm not sure what happened to make Flickr accounts go away, but I think I let it go away. Do you still have one?
I think it still exists. I think they just brought it down maybe to like the minimum number of photos you can have there on free.
I'm sure you can still find me on Flickr, but I'm not paying for it or anything.
Right. So, I mean, but I know you've got a list of things you want to cover as we're going down this, but do you think there's any kind of connection between effective use of blockchain, you know, for data? You were talking about maybe more mastery of one's data. Was that a fair characterization of what you're saying?
Yeah, mastery and disposition, right? Like, you know, you want to find, you have certain pieces of critical data you need to provide an institution in order to open an account or whatever. And you just want to zoop, 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 here you go. And it, you know, it just seems difficult now. There are places that, you know, require you to upload copies of your driver's license to verify your identity over and over and over again. Wouldn't it be nice if you just had you know, some easier and yet completely verifiable ways to,
like if OnlyFans could give me a token because I'm verified on OnlyFans.
Correct. Like that.
what I really wanted to ask though is about, is there any relation between what you're saying, this benefit of blockchain and the Fediverse, you know, on those types of technologies? Is there any connection, any kind of overlap there? I just want to see if we're thinking about sort of the same thing.
Yeah, I think there is a connection because in the way that, you know, anybody can access Mastodon and, you know, from any one of those nodes, and then be visible without any platform managing that content.
Yeah.
I do think we do need some sort of similar concept for our own just lives and data and our businesses, management of that kind of thing too.
So you still have a Twitter account? Or, I'm sorry, X?
I did not delete my Twitter account. It is still there. I don't use it. Yeah. Okay. How about you?
Yeah, I use it still a lot.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I have a Blue Sky account and mm-hmm. Mastodon and Threads and everything, but you know, most of my engagement still on Twitter. You know?
Yeah. I feel like at some point, if somebody steps in and puts out the dumpster fire, I would once again use that platform, but I'm kind of waiting for that to happen, I guess.
We'll talk offline. I'm looking for the dumpster fire. People say it's there. You know, Leo, of course, was the first to see a dumpster, you know, one of the first to see a dumpster fire. You know, he's, you know, gone. And, you know, Rick Clow, our mutual friend, Rick Clow.
Yes.
I mean,
uh-huh.
He was the one who told me about Twitter when we were sitting drinking beer in the spring of 2007. Mm-hmm. And so I went home and signed up for Twitter because Rick Clow told me to. And, you know, he's gone, you know. And
yes.
I mean, countless numbers of luminaries just no longer. They never existed there, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And I wanted to ask you about this as far as one way that you do live in the future, I think, as far as a person of our age or relative age, a person of our profession is you are an active, frequent TikTok user or TikTok creator, which is even more living in the future because I have a TikTok account. I very much enjoy using TikTok and following the people I follow. And when I do use TikTok, I only go to the following page. I don't go to the For You page. So I don't really experience how their algorithm feeds me things.
Right.
But
so
I do
the Chinese
see
government hasn't gotten you thinking what it wants to think yet.
I don't think so. But when one thing I do get is all kinds of great legal insight from you.
Thank you.
And the other, I mean, so there are numerous ways that you are using tools where, you know, others of our generation would be scratching their head and saying, gee, I just don't get that, or I'm certainly not using it and I'm kind of suspicious of it, because you are creating great legal synopsis videos on TikTok and you're using AI to do it as well.
Yes.
And in fact, you are probably one of the only lawyers out there who has deep faked himself and put himself on TikTok.
Right, right.
So speak to that a little. Tell me about that experience.
I think you and I are very similar in this respect, Denise. We really enjoy creating content. We're interested in these things and we want to share it with people. And this is the same conversation you could have about any kind of online activity where you're creating content, whether it's just writing or sharing photos or creating short form videos like you see on TikTok or Reels or whatever. So it's fun to do. It's interesting. It's inherently satisfying. It's autotelic. You know what I mean? The end in and of itself is the reward. And so you want to a person who has that enthusiasm, like you and I do, you want there to be engagement. You don't want to just be speaking into the void. You know, you want it to be something that's useful, that people want to engage with. You want it to be relevant. So, I'm going, oh, pshaw, when you say, that's a term that I use because I'm from the Midwest, probably.
From an older generation.
That's right. Right. So when you say that I'm a TikTok creator, because I'm not like, Is Charlie D'Amelio still a thing? I'm trying to think.
I don't know. I would have to say yes.
I'm trying to sound like I know about current content creators on TikTok, but I'm probably really sounding like, you know, like I'm from Ohio at this point, or, you know, skibbity. So there's this notion of being a creator of this short form content that I just find really satisfying. And what I try to do is just pick one or two ideas, you know, for really one idea in a short video, maybe two or three points, break it out. I have found that they tend to, this might be subjective, but I think I could probably support it with some of my engagement data, seem to be taken a little more seriously. If I'm speaking as a lawyer, I'm not wearing a tie right now or a jacket, but you put on a tie and jacket and, you know, say something, have some interesting images go by, something that's current. Sometimes what I do is like breaking news. Other times it's just sort of riffing on an idea, like, you know, when Colorado passed the statute on neural privacy. I thought that was really interesting because that's the first of its kind where there's this law now that recognizes a category of data that gives you protection essentially from someone reading your mind without your authorization. So compressing that down into 1 minute is something fun to do. You mentioned I use AI to generate these things. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. At a number of layers in the process. First of all, creating the script. I kid you not, I enter in some just sort of free form paragraph thinking about it with some ideas. And at the end, I say, rewrite this in 200 words as if it were written by a 10th grader. So then that sort of breaks the script down into even more of presentable form. And then, of course, visually using AI quite a bit. Yeah, there was one where I don't think it was around the time of the I forget the subject matter, what it was, but it had something to do with, maybe it was just deepfakes in general, sort of identifying some of the issues, like, you know, privacy issues or dignitary tort kind of issues that arise around deepfakes. I did that once, but, you know, certainly use a lot of imagery generated by AI. And the concern now is just not being cliche-ish in the imagery. You know, there's certain hallmarks of what AI-generated images look like. And sometimes I don't worry about it. I'm looking at my most recent blog post here. It's obviously, you know, a DALL-E kind of thing. But yeah, there's creative ways of generating the imagery as well to add interest to it as well.
Right. And as a lawyer, you're more aware than any other creator would be, especially as an intellectual property lawyer, of the fact that the Copyright Office now wants people to disclose if AI has been used in works that are attempted to be registered. I'm sure the Patent and Trademark Office is right in there with those kinds of disclosure requirements. YouTube wants you to disclose if you're using AI in your creations. In the case of a platform like YouTube or TikTok, do you think that's really just kind of CYA on their part that, oh, you were supposed to disclose and you didn't? So someone, you know, has objected to, flagged your video and we can pull it down on that basis. Is that really what the purpose of that is? And does it impact you as a creator? Are you paying attention to, gee, I better check the right boxes?
Yeah. Don't you think that there's a number of motives, you know, that these platforms have for doing that? One might be CYA. Another one is to give them another tool in their arsenal of content mediation or content moderation. You know, that's such a challenge. And if you have a basis upon which you can take some content down because it portrays someone in a false light or whatever, having been tagged or having a requirement that it be tagged saying, yes, I used AI to do this. And if it's not tagged, then that's an independent basis to take it down rather than having to make this decision on whether it actually was an invasion of someone else's privacy or something like that.
Right.
Imagine another motive is just to gather data. You know, how much of our content on this platform now is used generating this stuff. So I think there could be, we could sit here and probably come up with a half dozen other motives for it as well. Another one could just be pure altruism. We just want everybody to know, you know, don't you have the right to know that something is authentic and not generated, you know, to imitate real life. Because it is funny, YouTube's, I don't know what, like, I know TikTok has the little thing as well where you have to check a box, and maybe Instagram does too on Reels. But I know with YouTube, you know, their actual policy amendment that talks about this is like, you don't have to do it if it's obviously not imitative of life. You know, if it's like a cartoon character or something like that. So that just goes to that question, or, you know, that would seem to be motivated by a desire to ensure that people know the truth and that they're not being misled in subtle ways. So then what was the second part of your question, or second part of your comments, is like, how does that affect me? You know,
I think you answered that you're, you know, paying attention to what's asked of you as you're uploading these things and disclosing. Yeah. But I think, I mean, knowing that you're doing that doesn't make me believe that 99% of the people uploading content aren't just blowing right by that. Right. Number one, because they don't really understand. Number two, if they do understand, they don't care. Yep. So I do think
how much of the work actually has to have been created in that way? You know, if it's just one or two seconds of a whole, you know, series of images or passages, you know.
Right. Back to the spell check point.
Yeah.
So I guess my final question, looking toward the future here, with a topic that we discussed a lot on This Week in Law, and whether or not the current First Amendment challenge to TikTok will be sufficient to upend the ban, as an earlier First Amendment challenge to TikTok was it Montana?
Yes.
The Montana Supreme Court.
It was a federal court in Montana.
It was a federal court. A district court. Yeah.
Yeah.
In
fact, it was just the district court. And I think it's still before the Ninth Circuit. I think
we can talk a little bit. Yeah. We'll see what happens with that. But we can talk a little bit about the First Amendment ramifications surrounding the ban. But I'm just wondering, more as a practical matter, you gave us a couple of things to riff on before the show, and one was blank is to 2024 as blogging was to 2005. Yeah. And I love that. And if I filled in the blank, I might put TikTok is to 2024 as blogging was to 2005. But maybe what I mean is video shorts, because if TikTok were to go away, you would keep using Reels and probably YouTube Shorts and other ways of putting that kind of content out there. You don't see any magic sauce to TikTok itself?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think what the principle at work here is, and I think that it's a tautology to say that, you know, fill in that blank with TikTok or short form video. But what's the tautology is with some form of content that matches the attention span that we've trained ourselves to have.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Uh-huh. And so, you know, we all have different habits. And I think most of us would probably, if we're being honest with ourselves, would say we would like to change our habits and make ourselves more organic. I mean, I spend way too much time mindlessly. I'll confess my sins. I spend more time than I should mindlessly browsing, you know, just doing this. You know, sometimes it's the first thing I do when I wake up in the morning. And so, you know, for good or evil, you know, my attention span, the way that my cognitive functions work to guide me through the day and taking in information is qualitatively different than it was 20 years ago. And so, going back to what I said earlier, I don't want to speak for you, Denise, but I surmise from you that you really enjoy creating content that people want to engage with. That's why we're here talking, right? We want this to be to stimulate a larger conversation and all of that stuff. You know, we've got to do whatever it is to match that. I don't know. Maybe we should call it an attention economy or something like that. I don't know. Has anybody ever characterized it that way?
Yeah, definitely. Lots of people. I see something in what you're saying in having short form video fulfill this sort of sifting role where you're going through little chunks of data. And if something is particularly useful, to you, you have ways of diving deeper into it and not just the whatever 60-second format or whatever you're looking at.
See that on shorts a lot, YouTube shorts, because you know, you can associate a longer form video. So I think there's a lot of creators doing interesting stuff there to draw attention to their longer form content on YouTube.
Right. Well, I mean, one current example I could give you is there was a reel on Instagram I saw that was from a cooler manufacturer. And this cooler manufacturer had made this, for lack of a better description, it's not something you put your drinks into with ice, not that kind of cooler. It is a cooler that you make drinks in, and then it's got little spigots on the outside where you can pour the drinks out. So it's a great party tool. Yes. And to promote that party cooler, they had, I think it was a couple of young women, creating what my son calls jungle juice and what I called champagne punch in the cooler, which was bottle after bottle after bottle after bottle with orange slices, strawberries, et cetera, getting poured in, ice at the end and champagne at the end. And I'm like, oh my God, that looks delicious. And it's summertime and we are so going to make that. So of course I couldn't take in everything that was involved in creating said jungle juice just by watching the video, because it went by too quickly. But of course you can pause and write, okay, I recognize that bottle. And I could usefully dive deeper on what I was seeing. And we did create the punch and it was delicious. But in any event,
were you having as much fun as the people in the
Nowhere near. Nowhere near as much. Although we did have a nice outdoor interlude, thanks to the cooler manufacturer. And I feel like that, like, our whole generation of kids is growing up knowing how to cook because of short form videos. Right? Do you agree with your sons?
Oh, absolutely. I was getting ready to say that. Our 16-year-old in particular, you know, he's more of an Epicurean than your average 16-year-old kid. And so, you know, his algorithms on both TikTok and on Reels, you know, really skew heavily toward the culinary. And I know that we've enjoyed several meals where, you know, he's forwarded, you know, a reel to mom, who then, ordered it up. You know, the ingredients, and, you know, we enjoyed that. And, you know, so that's the way that we became aware of it. So yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, just to close out this notion of things that we talked about a lot on This Week in Law and sort of visit where they are today. One thing we talked about over and over again is the ability of law enforcement to access one's computer or phone via either compelling you to disclose your password or compelling you to give your biometric information. And those two things do make a difference, either situation as far as the Fifth Amendment is concerned and the right against self-incrimination. So I would say that is still a hot mess. Do you agree?
I guess it doesn't, maybe it's just where I'm looking or not looking. It doesn't seem like that you see it as much. Maybe there are cases coming down on it, but I think it's one of those things where we're used to it being an issue. So we don't see it as something, oh, this is like something we got to pay a bunch of attention to because it's new. I don't know. It one thing might be the actual technologies involved, because what was it called when Apple had the thumb thing on the button? I mean, what was that technology called? Can't even remember, but it was new.
Hang on, I'm Googling Apple thumb thing.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of those things where it would have been the top of our consciousness back then.
Touch ID, Evan, Touch ID.
Of course. Did that Google search actually?
It did. Okay. And in fact, let me just duplicate it one sec because I'm curious now. What I put in was Apple thumb thing identity. No, it was not actually Gemini that gave me the result. It was the top result for me at any rate using Google was use Touch ID on iPhone and iPad from Apple support. So
okay. But you see, the point is that was new. That was a big step. And so, but we've become accustomed to those things, because I don't even think about it now using Face ID, you know, for those things or other I guess that's really the big biometric thing we use. So
yeah,
I would imagine it's still a hot mess because, you know, you're dealing with such important life issues every time that comes before a court, because you're dealing with somebody's freedom. You know, they're dealing with their real heavy constitutional rights. And so I don't know that that would ever be resolved, not so much because the legal issues are new, but the application of those legal principles in every factual situation is one that's just going to get so much scrutiny and so much attention because of the drastic consequences concerning the outcome.
That, right.
Is that person going to jail or not?
Yeah. The Utah Supreme Court had one of the more recent cases on this, and they determined that the Fifth Amendment barred disclosure of a password, even where there was a warrant that said, you've got to turn over your password. But what the court said that was interesting was, all you have to do, law enforcement, is draft your warrant such that it says, turn over an unlocked phone, so that you're not requiring the person to disclose their biometrics or their password. They're having to apply it and then hand you the device. So
isn't that funny? You just go ahead and ask for what it is you really want.
Right. Yeah. Right. Right. And of course, then, you know, make sure it locks itself after a short amount of time. Apple's built in some controls for that, privacy and locking technologies that I'm not completely up to speed on, but I know they're there.
And what, was it? It was the San Bernardino shooting case, wasn't it? Where that was a big issue.
Apple was being compelled to decrypt things in its cloud and turn it over to the FBI. Yes, very interesting. Living as you do in Illinois, which has a biometric privacy law that I think might still be unique in the United States. I don't know if other states.
Certainly one you hear about.
It is, yeah. Do you know of any interesting ways that that has come up? Or are we still, like the neural privacy one, is it still just not as widespread so we don't hear about
it? There's a lot of litigation over it. And most of the lawyers that I know who are thinking and working with BIPA, the Biometric Information Privacy Act, right? I think it's what it stands for. And it's synonymous with, you know, Illinois, because it's where it is here. It's a state law. The lawyers that I know who are dealing with that aren't so much in love with the subject matter of privacy, but they are class action litigators. Most of the lawyers I know are, you know, are working on the defense, representing companies who implement some kind of system to authenticate a person, you know, rather than punching a time clock, you know, scan your thumb to prove you were at work. And so the big issues are with consent. You know, was there a right disclosure to the person? Was there the correct consent given? And it's just, it's a gold mine for plaintiffs, class action lawyers. I don't even know what the damages are, but they're in the big numbers, you know, for each violation. So the way that it actually pans out is in class action litigation, where, and I don't know if you remember me or sort of being a little bit cynical about that whole business model of class action. What I don't like about, I think class action litigation is good because it provides a remedy to a broad number of people, where each one individually wouldn't have the incentive to fight as hard as they need to get just a few cents back, you know, for their refund from T-Mobile or whatever. But what I don't like is the way that lawyers tend to be over remunerated, disproportionately remunerated for these things. I mean, there's just, you know, it's incredible.
Right. And the way that cottage industries of law practice spring up around new laws, where opportunistic lawyers go, aha, if we go through and methodically look for X, Y, and Z, we're going to make some money.
I'll say it so you don't have to. They're trolls.
Yes, absolutely. All right. Well, I did mention that we should talk about TikTok's chances in its First Amendment challenge. And one thing that we constantly were clarifying on our show, because people tend to get really confused about this, is that the free speech aspect of TikTok, the U.S. constitutional free speech ramifications of TikTok, aren't necessarily that people use TikTok to express themselves. That's not why there's a First Amendment argument here. The First Amendment argument is because the government is enacting a ban of that platform. And it always takes a government action in order for the First Amendment to be implicated. So we do have a classic First Amendment argument to be made here. And TikTok's lawyers are going to make it. What do you think is going to happen there?
Well, there's two different categories of speech involved. It's TikTok's speech, you know, its ability to operate this platform, run a business. And then there's the free speech interest of the users. Mm-hmm. What is it? I'm sure this number has increased more, but back in, as of March, it was, 70 million or no, more than that, wasn't it? 170 million Americans using TikTok, and then so many small businesses and everything like that. So, So there's two parts of it. And we saw a little bit of a preview of that in the Montana litigation, the litigation that came out of the federal court sitting in Montana, because Montana passed a law in 2023 that tried to ban it, or that did ban it. It passed, but there was an injunction entered because of this free speech issue. And it's a little bit different. We can't look at those as perfectly isometric tea leaves, if you will, to see how it's going to pan out in the litigation that's happening in federal court in Washington, D.C. over this, because the interests at stake. Remember, the classic First Amendment analysis is, what kind of scrutiny applies here? And so if it's strict scrutiny that ought to apply because it's a content-based restriction, it has to be narrowly tailored to meet a compelling government interest. I wish Mark Randazza was here right now instead of me trying to talk about this. And so the government interests at play when the state of Montana issued or, passed this statute are different than the federal government doing it, because the court in part said Montana doesn't have any interest in regulating national security. That's the federal government's job. But what we do see in the comparison is the way that you're looking at these two classes of parties whose free speech interests are at stake here. And I think, and you may not want to leave the free speech issue quite yet, but we can't forget that there are other constitutional issues at play here. I wake up every morning, don't you, thinking about Bill of Attainder?
For me, it's more of a before I go to bed thing.
Oh, okay. Okay. Because you need help sleeping. I see.
Right.
That's not a Bill of Rights issue. That's in the body of the Constitution that they passed in 1789, saying you can't pass a law that, sort of retroactively messes with or, singles someone out. It's not the retroactive part, but it's the singling somebody out as being a criminal. You can't pass laws like that. And then there are two aspects. We were just talking about the Fifth Amendment, but this idea of there's an equal protection component to the Fifth Amendment, and also a takings clause. You can't take somebody's stuff without, just compensation. So as far as constitutional issues go, we've got a real nice cornucopia. But of course, all the attention at the top line goes to the free speech First Amendment stuff.
Right. TikTok case. But before we leave that topic, or sort of shifting away from that topic a little obliquely, I'm just wondering, because you and I both create a lot of content online, I'm wondering where you have come down over the years, both, with your blog posts and now your video shorts and various other things you create. Are you registering any of that with the Copyright Office?
I don't bother.
And I think I know the answer to that. If you ever had to sue about it, you could register it then.
Right. Yeah. Could then. And the reason I would even sue at that point would be to get injunctive relief, not necessarily money damages.
Right.
So you need to be worried about the timeliness of a registration. I can't remember it exactly. Can you? Something to do with 3 months.
Yeah. Something. There is a little window there. Right.
We're in a very informal setting here, not a CLE, but you have to file your copyright application in a certain amount of time in order to get attorney's fees and statutory damages. And so I probably forfeit that in most situations because I don't file a copyright application right away. But yeah, in 20 years of doing this stuff, I haven't filed a single copyright application for myself. Have you?
No, I have not. Yeah.
I mean, if I wrote a book or something, I would probably be more concerned about it, but
yeah,
I don't have the attention span right now. I've already admitted. write a book at this
That's
moment.
Right. We can barely get through our feeds. The other thing, well, and maybe this is related. The other thing you mentioned before the show that was kind of on your mind was this concept of being AI tired. And I assume you meant as to you personally, but I could see this also being a societal thing as we move forward. And as we come into that time that I spoke about where it's hard to come across any sort of work that hasn't had some brush against or involvement with AI before it became a final product. Where do you stand on being AI tired right now?
Professionally, more than anything, in a number of different ways. You know, we haven't talked about LinkedIn yet, have we? On this
not
episode.
Yet. No, let's
That's
talk about LinkedIn.
Depressing. That's the most depressing social media platform for me right now, because you log. And I'm being a little tongue in cheek, you know, obviously, but you know, I look at it and I scroll through and I see like what is it? Is it IAPP, the International Association of Privacy Professionals, now has a new certification called AIGP, right? An AI governance professional. It's like, oh, do I need to get that? And what is that involved? And that's just one of, you know, 10 new certifications that you might read about. And different countries are enacting statutes that don't really regulate anything, but they develop this governing body that's going to put a roadmap for the ethical use of AI. And that's happening both in Singapore and the United States and Canada, you know. And so it seems to be a bunch of force multipliers working together, because you know that AI, the use of AI technologies, is driving a lot of this stuff. And so there's this exponential growth in the complexity of everything happening everywhere, regulating it in so many different ways, that it's very easy to get caught up in the noise of all of this. And this has been a motif of our conversation. Denise, you're like this too, right? One of the joys of practicing as a technology lawyer is being able to jibe with your clients, in the sense that they're a much more sophisticated technologist than you are, but you at least know what they're talking about and have and share an enthusiasm with it. Right. So I just today, particularly, I might feel much more energized next week. I felt better last week. Today, I'm just experiencing a little bit of AI tired, a little bit of AI fatigue on the notion of just keeping up with all the new developments with the various LLMs, the different regulatory frameworks, the different ways that you can demonstrate competence as a professional, whether as a lawyer or a technologist or a privacy consultant, and just sort of then at the same time, integrating sort of one's philosophical, sociological, cultural observer notions on, should we be doing this at all? Should we pull the plug and just, you know, be, you know, doing stuff?
Right. Well, I definitely see what you're saying. And you've written a couple of times about the need for companies to think about having an AI governance framework, which I think you were referencing AI governance bodies and rules. Right. And when I read about that, I just think, okay, yeah, there's going to be another compliance officer put in place. So AI is not stealing that job. job was created by AI.
Yes.
And also that whatever that AI governance framework looks like is going to sit on a digital shelf right along with the policies and procedures manual, and not have
harassment training that you do.
Yes, exactly. It's going to be there. It's going to be required, but is it really going to be internalized by the people who need to internalize it? I got to be skeptical about that.
Right. And I mean, naturally, what, you know, sort of a tender point in all this is the way that AI interfaces with privacy. You know, wouldn't you agree that, you know, data privacy issues are one of the big drivers behind the need to regulate AI, because of these vast amounts of data and the way that you can practically apply it to become smarter and figure out more stuff about people? This is just a big data issue we've talked about for a long time. And then, of course, there are the other legislative interests of, you know, things like avoiding bias and, you know, and making sure that these technologies are applied fairly. Those seem to be two really big drivers in sort of this AI governance thing. And then of course, intellectual property issues as well. But I don't know that the intellectual property issues are as close to the hearts of most policymakers as what you and I might wish they were, or, you know, the way we'd want to spend our time if we were involved in those conversations, because we love the intellectual property. Well, you love privacy a lot, though.
I do. Like I love it professionally and personally.
Well,
yes.
You know what I mean?
Yes, absolutely.
in just that one sense.
Yeah. And if, a moment ago when you said that LinkedIn was making you AI tired, I thought for sure you were going to say that it's all everyone's sort of engagement posts that they're putting out there to be active and dynamic on LinkedIn, and how AI generated a lot of those are becoming.
Yes. Yeah. And, you know, there's always a tell, or there's often a tell. Like, I've noticed that ChatGPT loves the word renowned, you know, something is renowned, you know.
That's a good one. Yes.
One thing that bugs the heck out of me about it as well is, so you studied English, right? Were you more?
I was an English major, literature.
Yeah. 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 So you, I don't know if this is a thing that comes across your consciousness in good writing, but if you say something general and then you want to give a list of examples, you'll say such as, you know, it's like, I enjoy playing sports such as baseball, volleyball, and squash. What ChatGPT would say, I enjoy playing sports like baseball. What did I say? Squash.
Volleyball and squash.
Volleyball and squash. And that uses that word like. I just don't think semantically that's the right thing, because it's not like. You're not trying to say that it's like that. You're saying these things are that. And these are examples. So that's just one thing. I'm spending way too much time on that. Sorry.
That's okay. If this is not the first rabbit hole we've gone down on the show, but it is approaching the last as we are running toward the end of our hour. Sadly, I could go on with you all afternoon, Evan. I asked you to think about some ways that you've been living in the future, and you are being very coy about that, but we've pointed out a few, and I'm just wondering if there were any others that came to mind that we haven't touched on today.
Oh gosh, you know there are. One of the things we could talk about more is sort of just how we use these tools in what we do day to day. You know, that's an entirely different category, probably for a different audience than what is probably tuning into this. But I think a lot of the principles about how you and I would think about using advanced technologies, even broader than just artificial intelligence, but bringing in some of these other things we were talking about, blockchain earlier, are going to drastically change the way that people do work. It's going to change the way lawyers do work. And I would just want to make a plea for optimism in all of this, because we're going to find ways of doing these things that free up our time so that we can focus more on ideas and things that are naturally more interesting to the human intellect. And, you know, so I always like to be optimistic at the end of any conversation about this stuff.
Okay, I'm going to ask you to gaze at the end of the show here into your and my and our collective generation's near future. Yeah. One thing that I'm sure you wind up doing all the time too for older friends or older family is helping them with their tech in different ways, and how that touches their lives in so many ways. So much of the medical establishment has gone so digital in all their communications. I find I'm having to log in and read my mom all her things from her medical portals. And, you know, she has a water heater repair person coming to the house and they want to be paid via an online link. That link has to come to me so that it can get paid, because that is beyond her capacity. So it's always been my hope, my fervent hope, but I'm not deluded about this, that our kids would not have to do this for us. I feel that they certainly will. How do you think that they will? What are you and I not going to know that our kids are going to know, and they're going to just roll their eyes and help us out?
The things that we don't care to know, because we will have become comfortable enough in how we are. You know, Gen X has got it made. You know, I'm sure you've seen the memes that talk about everybody's after the millennials or Gen Z, or of course making fun of the boomers. You don't, you don't mess with Gen X. And so we can just sort of be how we are. And, you know, when it comes that we have zero of them left to give, we'll be fine. So, yeah, there'll be stuff. We're naive to think that we won't look like codgers. Is that a bad word? but, you know, we won't care.
We'll just hunker down with our reruns of Breakfast Club and be oh so happy.
The house I live in, our house, was built in 1994. My office is here in the corner of the basement. And that 1,000 square feet over there of our finished basement, we're fortunate to have, is a time capsule from 1994 when this house was built. There's hunter green formica countertops and like the natural oak colored cabinets and like the little ceramic handles. There's a cutout above where the fridge is for a CRT, a cathode ray tube television. So, so I always want to invite friends over if we could find, you know, some Red Dog. You remember Red Dog, the beer?
Zima.
You know, other 90s, and then just like watch reruns of Seinfeld and Friends on the TV up there.
Right. Well, in fashion circles, the 90s have never left. The 90s rule the roost. Yeah. They are everything, and they're more everything now than they have ever been. So yeah. I think you, around, yeah, we'll just hunker down in your little time capsule and call out to the kids, text them saying, hey, we need help launching such and such. Get down here.
Yeah, we ask for the QR code and they're like, it's like, you know, using the phone book, you know.
Yeah. Well, Evan, I can't wait to learn what kinds of things that we are going to be incapable of doing for ourselves in the near future. But I am very happy that we've had the chance to get together today and reminisce a little bit and talk about our experiences and what has shifted, what has not, and what's going to shift in the future. Really, really enjoyed the conversation. Anything you want to leave our listeners with before we sign off today?
You were talking about some of my short form video content. I do some legal stuff. And so that's at Internet Cases on TikTok and Instagram. But I also have a side project called Same Day History. So it's at Same Day History on TikTok and Instagram. And so I try to put out one a week. I try to do this, you know, it's sort of a weekend project. But what I do is, you know, it's less than a minute talking about two interesting things that happen on the very same day, not just like this date in history, but like, for example, June 1st was the most recent when Marilyn Monroe and Andy Griffith were both born on the very same day. So I just talk about that a little bit. So that's a little fun thing I've got that I hope you would allow me to plug real quickly.
Oh, 100%. Thank you so much. Yeah, that's a nice twist on that this day in history notion. And I'm sure Marilyn Monroe and Andy Griffith they would reminisce fondly about their own generation and what set them apart.
Yes. Yeah.
I doubt they had too much in common, however. No. All right, folks, that's going to be it for this episode of Uneven Distribution here on the Hearsay Culture Network. We put out a couple of these a month. We hope you will continue to tune in. I also host another show on this network called R&D with D&D with Dave Levine, my co-founder here at Hearsay Culture. We're so pleased that you've joined us here today. We hope you'll keep coming back. You can subscribe to our shows on whatever your podcast platform preference may be. And you can also subscribe and support us in a concrete and paid way and get some benefits from that, such as access to the videos of these shows and access to Q&As after the fact, that kind of thing. So, and please let us know what else you would like to see from this network. We are at our very inception and want to make you happy with what we're putting out there. So please give me a shout whenever and whatever may pop into your mind about what you'd like to see on the network, what you'd like to see more of on the network, what's driving you nuts. All of it, please. I'm Denise at hearsayculture.com. Want to hear from you all and want to see you all again here on Uneven Distribution. See you soon. Bye-bye.
That wrap.
Hold on.